Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. First, in a few minutes, Darius Charney of the Center for Constitutional Rights on the New York City's Stop and Frisk court ruling, and then economist and historian Philip Murawski on the durable ideology of neoliberalism. Last week, I interviewed crime pundit Al Bloomstein, and he said some reckless things about the NYPD's practice of stopping and frisking what they consider to be suspicious people, meaning mostly young black and brown men. As a corrective, here is Darius Charney of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which has been litigating against the practice for years, and which a federal court judge deemed unconstitutional the other week. Here's Darius Charney with the details. Stop and frisk may not be as known to people outside New York as it is to New Yorkers, so just give an outline of what this policy has been and the scope of it.
Well, you know, stop and frisk has been a part of American policing for decades, and, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1968 in a case called Terry versus Ohio kind of set up the legal framework which would, you know, allow police officers to do this in compliance with the Constitution. And what the Supreme Court said was that for an officer to, you know, stop somebody on the street, you know, detain them briefly, ask them questions, that was a seizure under the Fourth Amendment, and therefore for it to be legal, the officer had to have what's called reasonable, articulable suspicion that the person who he or she was stopping was engaged in criminal activity. And if they were going to frisk them, in other words, pat down the outside of their clothing, they have to have reasonable suspicion that the person is armed and dangerous. But what has been happening in New York, really going back into the mid-90s during the Giuliani years when broken windows, zero-tolerance policing became kind of the hot thing, is that the NYPD just basically goes out and you know, stops people, you know, on the street, primarily in black and Latino neighborhoods, for, you know, highly questionable reasons. And what, you know, this case really, I think, shone a light on was that what they're essentially doing is just criminalizing entire communities and using race as a proxy for reasonable suspicion. And what I mean by that, and what the judge said in her decision, is that police department will look at their crime statistics, and, you know, they're very big into data in the NYPD, and, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing, but looking at those crime statistics and, you know, saying, okay, it looks to us like a disproportionate amount of the crime is being committed by black and Latino men. So what I want you guys to do, you know, commanders will tell their officers, is go out and, you know, focus on those groups. And they don't go out and say, you know, look for certain kinds of behaviors or, you know, look for certain kinds of, you know, objects. Just go out and focus on those groups because we know those are the people committing the crime. And that is exactly what we argued racial profiling is. It's what the Bush Justice Department defined racial profiling to be, and it's what the judge in our case found the New York Police Department to be engaging in.
And now, what are the pressures, I mean, starting from the top, starting from the mayor and the police commissioner, going down to the cop on the beat, what kind of pressures are these guys under to perform? What kind of review and what kind of pep talks do they get?
That's a, you know, good question. That's another thing that the judge talked about in her decision. You know, because of all this focus on numbers and you know, statistics, that actually has trickled down to the precincts and to the street level officers. And the way that's happened is that, you know, every month, and now I guess every week, police officers go through these performance reviews in which their enforcement activity is reviewed. You know, how many arrests they've done, how many tickets they've written, how many stops they've made, how many calls they've answered. And those numbers really are the focus of their performance evaluation. And the message that's being sent from the top down is that, you know, if you want to get ahead in the police department, you want to get the good assignment, you want to get the promotion, you got to show us some numbers. You got to show us that you're working, that you're busy. And, you know, officers are rewarded for, you know, high numbers of arrests, tickets, and, stops. And in some precincts, it's even become more explicit than that in terms of commanders actually setting quotas, saying, I expect you to get X number of stops a month or X number of tickets. And, some of those messages were actually recorded and played in court by, a few courageous officers who, were not comfortable with what was going on, actually recorded these things in roll calls and played them in the trial. So, again, this kind of thing is very widespread throughout the department. It's not an official policy, but it's clear that it happens. And, at trial, it came out that it was happening, all over the city. So that message of get your numbers up, coupled with the fact that there's really no inquiry or oversight of whether or not officers' conduct is actually constitutional and legal, that those two things together really create a recipe for, widespread constitutional violations of New Yorkers' rights.
And the numbers on the numbers of stops are stunning. So could you just review those?
So, in the 8-year period from 2000, I guess it's 9-year period, from 2004 through 2012, there were 4.4 million stops recorded by NYPD officers in the city of New York. And this is in a time of, very low crime, not only in New York, but nationally. To do that number of stops in that period, in fact, in 2011, there were almost 700,000 done. And, to do that many in a city that's, crime has not been going up. And just by way of comparison, the 700,000 in 2011, if you go back to the first year of the Mayor Bloomberg, Commissioner Ray Kelly era, 2002, there had only done 97,000. So in that, 9-year stretch, there was almost a 700% increase. And again, crime was either going down or remaining flat during that time. So the need for that many stops is beyond me. But, in about 90% of these stops, the police found no evidence of a crime. And when you talk about weapon recovery, which is ostensibly the reason they're doing this, they're trying to get illegal handguns off the streets in New York, which is a good goal, of course, but they say that that's the reason they do so many stops. They found weapons in only about 2% of the stops, and in terms of guns, it was about 0.15%. So to do that many stops, not find anything, stop that many people who are, for all intent and purposes, innocent of any wrongdoing, is extremely disturbing, I think, to most people who want the police in a democracy to behave a certain way. That's, of course, really disturbing to us. And then, of course, the racial disparities were incredibly severe. 85% of the stops are blacks and Latinos, who, together make up about 50% of the city's population. White pedestrians, who are about, 35% of the population in the city, were, less than 10% of the stops. Even though, interestingly enough, the recovery rate of stops of white people was actually a little bit higher than the recovery rate in stops of blacks and Latinos.
Yeah, well, actually, I believe the city's statistical expert seemed to claim that black people just behave more suspiciously than white people.
I laugh about that because I'm the one that questioned him during the trial on this, and they continued to just to bring out this same argument. And you heard Bloomberg say it last week when he reacted to the decision. It's like, the argument is, well, blacks commit more crimes, so of course we're going to stop them more. Latinos commit more crime, of course they're going to stop them more. But the big gap in their argument, and that's the one the judge honed in on, I think quite correctly, is that argument might make sense if you were actually stopping criminals, but you're stopping innocent people. And so, what you're left with then is that the police department believes that black people and Latino people are inherently more suspicious than white people. I guess because people in their community do commit crime. So I guess they're saying, well, hey, innocent folks, people who are trying to get to work, go to school, I'm sorry, we got to stop you, though, because other people in your community are, committing crime. And so that's, again, going back to, what the essence of racial profiling is, that's really what it is. It's criminalizing an entire community because you have some statistics that show there are certain people in that community who tend to commit crime.
4.4 million in a city of 8 million or so is an extremely high proportion, but of course, I've never been stopped. We're talking about repeated stops of a pretty narrow portion of the population, aren't we?
Yeah, we're talking about primarily young men of color in, you know, low and working class communities of the city. And that brings up another, I think, very interesting point around the statistics and the data, because one of the other, I guess, arguments that the city has made about these, to try to explain these disparities as well, you got to also look at where we police, right? So we go to what they like to call high crime areas, and those just happen to be majority minority, and so of course you're going to see more Black and Latino people be stopped. But what our expert looked at, this is Professor Jeff Fagan from Columbia, who's a professor of law and criminology and public health at Columbia, who's been studying these issues for about 15 years. What he did is he controlled for that issue. He said, well, okay, I'm going to grant you that there may be more crime in certain neighborhoods, and those neighborhoods may be, you know, primarily Black or Latino. But I'm going to, do a regression analysis, and I'm going to control for that, to compare. I want to compare stop rates in Black neighborhoods with stop rates in white neighborhoods, and I'm going to control for the fact that there's more crime in certain Black neighborhoods. And he found that even after you control for that, the disparities are so high that there's really no other explanation besides race for these disparities.
I'm speaking with Darius Charney of the Center for Constitutional Rights. What has the judge ordered now that the city changed its behavior? What does it have to do?
Interestingly, she ordered some pretty, I think, I don't think creative is the right word, but I guess kind of innovative remedies here. She found that the city had obviously been engaging in widespread 4th and 14th Amendment violations here, making stops without reasonable suspicion, using race improperly. And so what she ordered them to do is a combination of things, which, include some pretty immediate basic things, like, you got to train your officers better, you have to, revise the paperwork that they fill out to require them to put more detail so we can determine if these stops were legal or not. But she also ordered, and this was completely her idea, that they try out a pilot project in certain precincts that, where stop activity is high. For a year, they try out body-worn cameras on police officers. And this is a pretty new thing in American policing. It hasn't been done in very many cities around the country. It's a little more popular in, I guess, in the UK. And obviously, when you think about police wearing cameras, that obviously, for good reason, raises concerns for folks who care about civil liberties. So, we don't know how we feel about it at this point. I think the good thing that the judge did is she said it's going to be a pilot. We're going to try it out for a year. We're going to do it in a small number of precincts, and then we're going to evaluate and see, do the benefits outweigh the costs here. In terms of, people's privacy rights. The idea behind it being, of course, that, when you have a stop on the street, late at night, nobody's there to witness it except the police officer and the person, the civilian. And in order for us to really know what happened and whether the police officer did the right thing, we need to have a contemporaneous record of it. And that's impossible most of the time because there are no witnesses. So the idea here would be, look, this is going to provide a contemporaneous record of it. It would protect, actually, police officers who are doing the right thing from, invalid complaints, and it's, of course, going to hopefully protect the civilians who feel that their rights were violated. We'll see how it goes. So that's another thing she did.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but cops lie a lot.
Of course. And, that's, I think, the judge didn't say that, but, what she did talk about at trial was she was having a hard time reconciling different versions of the story. A pedestrian would say, this is what happened, and then the police officer would come in and say, no, this is exactly the opposite of what happened. And so she was like, how do I reconcile that when there are no other witnesses? Maybe if I had footage, and of course, we'd have to figure out a way to make sure they can't doctor the footage or edit it or alter it, which, of course, I don't know the technology of these things, so I don't know how that's going to work, but hopefully we can sort that out. But beyond those kind of specific measures she asked them or told them to take, she did two other things which I think are very interesting and we are cautiously optimistic about, particularly when we get a new administration that's hopefully a little more open about talking to us in January, and that is that she appointed a court monitor to oversee essentially two stages of a collaborative process to come up with remedies here. The first would be basically the monitor, us and the city sitting down and coming up with, you know, some of those training changes, some of the changes to the way they supervise officers and discipline them, and the monitor would also be consulting with experts in the field to figure out what the best practices are for these things. But the second piece of it, which would kind of unfold over a longer term and which I think we're very intrigued about, is the judge ordered what she called a joint remedy process, which would allow for a variety of stakeholders on these issues, you know, people from the most impacted communities, organizations that work with the most impacted communities, the police union, religious officials, the folks on the city council who have been very interested in this issue, to actually all kind of weigh in together in a facilitated, structured process. That's the key. It has to obviously have some kind of structure. The court would appoint a conflict resolution specialist to oversee this process and to, you know, through this process, come up with some, you know, more kind of broader, long-term remedies that hopefully would improve not only the police behavior, but police community relations throughout the city in the coming years. And so this is something that hasn't been tried. I only know of one other example of this being tried in the United States, which was in Cincinnati, Ohio, about 10 years ago. And it was fairly successful there in terms of, you know, really bringing about some meaningful reforms to what was at that point a pretty corrupt and racist police department. So we look to that model and hope that that can have some lasting effect here as well, but we'll see.
Now, of course, the cops will still be free to do stops and frisks, right?
Yes. You know, I mean, as the Supreme Court said 45 years ago, they can do it. It's just that they have to do it legally. And, you know, the mayor, in his remarks last week, which, you know, amounted to fear-mongering as far as I'm concerned, kept saying, you know, if you don't let cops do these stops, the crime rate's going to go up. I think he actually used the phrase, and I'm quoting him exactly, people will die. But besides the fact that that was very inflammatory, I think what he was glossing over is that the judge has never said, nor have we ever said, that the police department cannot do stop and frisk. What we've said is if you're going to do it, you have to do it in compliance with the Constitution. Police officers do this across the United States. You know, it is a pretty, it's one of the tools of American policing that has been with us for decades. But there are standards that you have to comply with to do it, and those are designed to protect people's privacy and protect their liberty. And in New York, they really have not taken the Fourth Amendment seriously at all. Obviously, in this stuff, you know, when you hear officers describe what they think constitutes reasonable suspicion, it can be incredibly alarming to hear what some of them say. And then, of course, this whole notion about group, and I think is, there was a good piece by Charles Blow in the New York Times about this, what he called it universal suspicion. In other words, you know, criminalizing an entire group of people, not because of the behavior of the, you know, the, not instead of looking at the individual behavior of the person you're stopping, using these generalized notions of who's suspicious in society to detain somebody. And so those things, I think, is just a complete disregard and disrespect for the constitutional rights of, you know, the citizens of the city, and that's really the problem here, not that they're doing stops.
A black friend of mine told me that a cop once told him that he's never been stopped because he wears glasses.
I mean, I guess does that police officer believe that nerds cannot commit crime? I don't know what that means.
Well, I think the explanation was that it's the kind of people, it suggests the kinds of people he hangs around with. He's not hanging out with a criminal element because he'd be beaten up for wearing glasses.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, of course, not only a race element here, but a class element. I mean, you're talking about, you know, young black and Latino men who, you know, live in, you know, the lower income parts of this city. And I guess the notion is that they fit the profile of who commits all the crime, regardless of the fact that even in those quote-unquote high crime communities, I mean, the vast majority of people that live there are just trying to live their lives, make a living, provide for their family, you know, do the right thing. And they're being criminalized basically because of where they live and who they look like. They fit the profile. The police like to say they fit the description, but that's not true. A description is a specific description that somebody gives when a crime is committed. You know, Latino male, 6'2", you know, weight of 160, but not, you know, well, all the suspects are black, so that means every black person we see is now a suspect.
Now, I'm sure there's a lot of people who would, perhaps not all of them Yahoos, who would argue, you know, you can't argue with success, and you're exposing the population to grave danger. And certainly that's the city's argument, but I suppose there are quite a few people in the city who might agree. What is your response to that kind of argument?
Well, I think there's three responses I would give. One is, again, I'll repeat that we have never said the police department should not use stop and frisk when it's appropriate to use it. When they observe a suspicious behavior, they should intervene because they can probably prevent a few crimes or a lot of crimes from happening if they, you know, actually have a basis to suspect somebody. But I think the two points which are more have to do with kind of criminological research on this issue are that first and foremost, there has never been an empirical study done anywhere in this country that I know of, and I've looked into this for many years that I've been working on this case, that in fact links, you know, increased use of stop and frisk to crime decline. And that's not just in New York, but anywhere. You know, the research in New York about the crime decline, and I think most recently it was Frank Zimmering at Berkeley that wrote about this, does show that the police department has done a lot of things right in the last 20 years, and I wouldn't disagree with that. You know, the CompStat system, for all its problems, has, I think, helped them figure out how to use their resources intelligently. It's helped them figure out what neighborhoods they should focus their policing on, and I think that has had very good effects on bringing crime down. But that's a vastly different thing from going out and just aggressively shaking people down and you know, stopping them, detaining them, roughing them up. There's no research to show that particular tactic, separate and apart from sending more officers to a high crime area, actually brings crime down. And in fact, there's a recent study done by Rick Rosenfeld, who is a very well-known criminologist at the University of Missouri. He looked at the NYPD's crime and stop data for, I think it was about a seven-year period, 2003 to 2010, and he just published a study which showed that stop and frisk had no significant impact on decreases in, you know, a lot of the major crime categories, robbery, burglary, murder, any, you know, the ones that we care about, the serious crime. It didn't have any measurable impact on the decreases in those crimes. Now, the other piece, though, which I think is really, really important to understand, this is the last thing I'll say on this, is in contrast to the dearth of research in the area of stop and frisk and crime reduction, there is a lot of research, particularly in the field of social psychology. And Tom Tyler at NYU is one of the leaders in this area, that talks about procedural justice. In other words, fair law enforcement, a criminal justice system that people perceive to be fair. That when people perceive the police to be acting unfairly and to be violating their rights, treating them differently because of their race, etc., that people are less likely to cooperate with the police, which of course has a really bad impact on their crime-fighting ability. And secondly, you know, less likely to report crime, less likely to cooperate as witnesses, that kind of thing. And it also, there's research that shows that particularly youth in urban areas are more likely to engage in illegal behavior because they view the criminal laws and the criminal justice system as unfair and therefore not worth participating in legally. And so, you know, that research, I think, really is very telling, particularly when we're talking about police-community relations here in New York City.
And then finally, what are the guarantees, if such things exist, that the city will actually obey the ruling?
Well, you know, now that we have a court order, there is a contempt power. But, you know, as you may know, on Friday, the mayor officially announced, and we received word of it through the courts, that the city has appealed the decision. What that means going forward in the coming months is, of course, a little unclear, given that we are going to get a new mayor and most likely a new police commissioner come January. And several of the candidates, the ones who appear to be ahead in the polls, have stated publicly they would drop the appeal if elected, which is good to hear. But, you know, I don't know what this means for the next 4 months in terms of the city's willingness to participate in these remedy processes, we have a court monitor who is empowered by the court to, you know, order the city to do things. The mayor has not given any indication that they have any interest in, you know, being part of the solution here, but, you know, he's only got 4 months left, so it's a little up in the air what's going to happen. I mean, I think we're optimistic that, you know, if the appeal goes forward, we would be successful, and we're also optimistic that this appeal hopefully will go away come January.
That was Darius Charney of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Police State by UK Subs. Next, Philip Murawski. Murawski teaches history and economics at Notre Dame and is author of Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste, How Neoliberalism Survived the Financial Meltdown, just out from Verso. There's valuable material in the book, but it's marred by a windy and mannered style. The intellectual history of the spread of neoliberalism and the configuration of the neoliberal self, in which we're all entrepreneurs rather than workers or citizens, are important topics. It's too bad that this 450-page book couldn't be boiled down to about 20 or 40 tightly written pages. In the opening question, I said that Murawski includes Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz, purported critics of neoliberalism, among the neoliberals' ranks. He denies that. I'll concede that I phrased the question imprecisely. What I should have said is that while Krugman and Stiglitz are considered critics of neoliberalism, they never fundamentally challenge economic orthodoxy. Murawski repeatedly makes the claim in the book, and I don't know why he didn't say that. We talk some about the distinction between esoteric and exoteric doctrine, drawn from the right-wing political theorist Leo Strauss. Strauss's original argument is complicated, but the version that's achieved popularity is that in matters of politics and philosophy, there's one set of arguments meant for public consumption, the exoteric, and one for an inner circle of the trusted, the esoteric. Philip Murawski. Welcome. First of all, I would like a definition of neoliberalism, how you see it. You know, I think a lot of people would think of Milton Friedman when they hear that term, but you also include people like Stiglitz and Krugman, who are sometimes seen as critics or outsiders. So what is the definition of neoliberalism to you?
Okay, well, first, I don't include Stiglitz or Krugman in the neoliberal definition. The book goes into great detail to differentiate between neoclassical economics, which, of course, dates back to 1870, and I've written about this, is actually copied from physics of that 19th century, to neoliberalism, which really only dates from the 1930s at its earliest. There is no short definition of neoliberalism. That's why there's a whole chapter on that in the book, which argues that it's not a fixed doctrine. It can't be reduced to the ideas of a single person, like people often think of Friedrich Hayek as sort of the Marx of neoliberalism. And that's not quite true either. What it is it's an organized thought collective who seeks to rethink liberalism. Hence, the title neoliberalism makes a lot of sense there. And the way that they rethink it is that classical liberals really did believe in laissez-faire and a night watchman state, a state who had a separate function that had to be kept in its place, and then, of course, the market, which was separate from that. The neoliberals, and this is a very short definition and therefore imprecise, don't believe in that distinction anymore. The neoliberals believe that what is needed for their kind of market society to come about is that there has to be a strong state, which the neoliberals need to occupy. And their objective is basically to bring about the kind of market world that they think is ideal, which means, of course, that it doesn't already exist or it doesn't necessarily grow by itself. It's frustrating to listen to discussions of politics, both on the right and left in the United States, because they are so fixated on that older notion of laissez-faire that they don't understand the extent to which the argument has moved on quite a bit. And it also explains why, even though the right has managed to be in power from time to time, both in many different countries, the size of the government has not shrunk in that simple-minded sense. And that's because that's only the public face of this movement. They don't really expect that if you create the kind of market society and market state that they want, that the government will in some absolute sense shrink.
And that distinction between the public and private faces is important, because you spend a lot of time on the Mont Pelerin Society and the kind of inner and outer notion of the truth, which is related to Strauss's esoteric and exoteric philosophy. Let's talk some about the Mont Pelerin Society, which is almost some sort of Leninist party of capital.
Mont Pelerin Society started in 1947, and it was meant to be both a discussion society, in other words, to rethink the nature of a future liberalism, which would be more politically effective. But at the same time, and Hayek admits this, and a number of others did too, it was also meant to be a political organization. It was to build up a kind of a political movement from the ground up. The way it did this is it didn't do it initially all at once. It had to have a large number of people think through what this organization would look like. And a lot of it is built around, I think, a central neoliberal notion of the market, the ideal market, as the best information processor known to mankind. That is, no one is ever smarter than the market. And that, of course, becomes their central argument against socialism. That is, people can't run the economy because they don't know as much as the market does. But it also has interesting political effects. And the political effects it has is that if the market really is smarter than any human being, should you just sort of sit still and, you know, wait for it to bring about the right kind of market society because it knows more? Or should you act? And see, that was, I think, the great internal contradiction of early Mont Pelerin, which they eventually overcame by this distinction between a kind of an exoteric doctrine that sounds libertarian, even though it's not, an internal doctrine, an esoteric doctrine, about what is needed to be done to create the kind of knowledge that would result in their eventual dominance of politics. And that's why I spend so much time on knowledge in the book, because I agree actually with one of the Mont Pelerin members, Hernando de Soto, that the crisis is really a crisis of epistemology. It's not a crisis of mere bubbles, okay? So what it is that, you know, how can you behave in such a way that you can support the idea of a market as the ideal knowledge producer and information processor, but at the same time, you act to bring that about in ways that a cadre of mobilized groups have to understand. And by the way, I want to be clear who those mobilized groups are, that the Mont Pelerin never rises above 500 people. And so it's clearly not just Mont Pelerin. What it is a whole ring of outer units and organizations that are built up around Mont Pelerin, many of which are think tanks that people are familiar with. The IEA, Heritage, American Enterprise Institute, so forth and so on. And the actual political activity, which is conditioned to the nation that it's in, and by the way, it's spread throughout the world, another point that I want to make in the book, is largely happens in those outer rings, like the think tank organizations, like the ability to astroturf political movements, the way in which the Tea Party was started, but to a large extent, well before the crisis, as part of the tobacco strategy to alter people's attitudes towards the science of smoking. I mean, that's an amazing thing that I think people don't realize to a great extent. So that a lot of this is about a much more elaborate structure than I think people who simply, especially people on the left, think.
This touches on an important
contradiction in their philosophy, or perhaps at least the exoteric version of the philosophy. Supposedly, this tendency in politics is associated with freedom, yet they have a great fondness for figures like Augusto Pinochet. What about the relation between economic freedom and political freedom in the Mont Pelerin worldview?
Yeah, people on the left like to bring up Pinochet, and of course that's a legitimate incident in the history. But I think that the question of freedom is much more twisted and elaborate in the long history of Mont Pelerin than even bringing up a simple contradiction between a dictator and their, their preaching of freedom. That is, they argue quite a bit with each other about the nature of freedom. And one way they try to square the circle is they try to argue that political freedom is only a function of economic freedom. That is, that there's no independent thing as political freedom, unless, of course, the market is totally has its sway in terms of, defining what is and is not possible. So that's one of their responses to this issue. But I mean, there are actually a number of other responses. I mean, there's some very interesting differences, for example, between, let's say, somebody like Hayek, somebody like Friedman. Hayek sees freedom as having a lot to do with knowledge. That people have their own personal understandings of freedom, but the personal understandings themselves have to be subordinate to the development of the market. I mean, it's a very interesting sort of circular notion as to why there is no such thing as one way to put it is there is no such thing as positive freedom, citing Isaiah Berlin. Positive freedom, at least in Berlin's definition, is the idea that you should have not only an absence of state interference, but that you should have the ability to become the person that you are able to become. In other words, that you should have, enough resources or so forth to develop towards a freedom worth having. They, by and large, hate that. Neoliberals do not like that idea. So freedom is only a freedom from restraints from them. And by the way, it's largely just a freedom from market restraints. Now, other kinds of restraints, in a sense, count less or don't count.
We also say that in this worldview, freedom should be distributed unequally as wealth.
Mm. See, I mean, that's something that's very interesting about the neoliberals, that they have directly confronted the idea that a fully developed market world is one.
The Skype signal briefly dropped out here. What is missing is in which inequality, as in their world is one in which inequality is not only rife. Back to the original.
Not only rife, but necessary, because that is the thing that keeps people striving to participate in the market and become these kind of, market people that would succeed. All right.
I'm speaking with Philip Murawski, author of Never Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste. Another paradox of this is that Hayek, who talks about the market as a producer of knowledge or a disseminator of knowledge, also celebrates the virtues of ignorance. How is that?
That is very interesting development in the history of neoliberalism. And it has to do with the whole idea of agnotology, which is an idea that if you really believe in the marketplace of ideas, then you believe that anyone should be able to more or less claim anything as truth. Because, of course, that's what freedom in the marketplace looks like. And truth would only become validated by the market itself that knows more than any other person. So what that means is that it's basically okay for people who have resources, in other words, rich people, to pay people to sort of fog the minds of the populace by claiming all sorts of, strange thing and largely untruthful things. And a very good example of this is the denialist movement in global warming. Whereas other people might be offended by this and say that, there's a sort of a crass conflict of interest of these people just going out and saying whatever, that global warming isn't happening. For the neoliberals, that's okay. Because no human being actually knows the truth, that no scientist actually knows the full truth. The full truth would only become manifest in the fullness of time through the market. And so if people are made more ignorant by constant, befogging of all kinds of arguments, including, by the way, arguments about the crisis, that is a good thing and not a bad thing. You see, ignorance is not something that needs to be pushed back. Ignorance is essentially the natural status of humankind, and the market exists to sort of work with that ignorance.
Makes you wonder why they get out of bed in the morning, though.
No. This is the hardest part, I think, for people on the left, to understand the ways in which this can be a very sort of uplifting and happy view of human life. And I try to talk about this in the last chapter of the book, where it's, what do they think they are really doing? I start off using global warming as the first example. What they're doing is they have a full spectrum response to political crises. And summarizing very briefly, in the short term, what they need to do is they just need to sort of stymie their opponents. And that's the role of the denialism, this whole idea that, you can just pay people to deny that there's a crisis and that's okay. But really what that exists for is to buy time. In the medium term, their story is, if people think that there really are market failures, the best way to fix those is to invent even new and stranger markets with the help of the state. See, that's the importance of the strong state. But even then, I don't think that they think that that's the ultimate or final solution. The final solution is always a kind of a wide-eyed science fiction, happy future solution. The long-term solution, in the case of global warming, is geoengineering, which is the idea of basically trying to do things to the atmosphere and to the ocean in order to live with a world which is both warmer and has a lot more carbon dioxide. So, for example, spewing all kinds of sulfur particulates up into the stratosphere is one supposed science fiction solution to global warming. My point is not to focus on that so much, but the idea that they have these notions of grand technological developments that will be brought about by entrepreneurs who, by the way, privatize these solutions in the future. And that's how the world is going to fix crises. And there's actually an equivalent between those three to the economic crisis as well. The short term, which is documented in the book, is denialism of the crisis, which we don't need to go into. The medium term is the privatization of the rescue of the banks. For most people don't realize that much of the central bank rescue of the banks was in fact outsourced to private financial firms. And then the grand long-term vision is in fact financial engineering. The idea that the way to fix all these crises of finance are to have private entrepreneurs invent even stranger and more elaborate financial instruments, which will somehow save us from the present, debt-ridden situation. So I think that they themselves have an upbeat vision of the future, which you can't ignore when you just focus on things like the denialism.
And, of course, this is the paradox that's at the center of your book, is you would think that the financial crisis of 2008 would have discredited these people utterly, yet here they are, at least as strong as ever. What happened?
Yeah, and the short version is that they have a well-developed and distributed response to crises now that's distributed across their think tanks, their various academic units, and so forth, where there's not just one answer. I mean, what they do is they tend to occupy the entire space of possible answers to the crisis. And I've just given you an example there, from denialism to what the Fed actually did, to the idea that financial innovation will save us, such that they occupy the entire space of possible alternative solutions to the crisis, blocking out all other alternative solutions, which in the particular case of the crisis, the one that they were most concerned to block out was the takeover of the banks and essentially the breaking up of the banks. That would have been a solution, but they were mobilized to prevent that from happening. And see, I think that the left has nothing as sophisticated as that. A distributed set of multiple types of responses which work together to produce, the final end.
Since reading the book, I was wondering precisely what the source of power that that neoliberal economics and neoliberal economists have in the society. You quote David Harvey's explanation, which is that it provides a theoretical groundwork for making the rich richer, which satisfies the vulgar Marxist in me. What's your explanation of why these people have such power and influence?
No, I think it's much more than that, because then the whole thing would just be reduced to, you know, who has the most money. And it's not that simple. That what's happened, and the reason why I write this history of the neoliberals, is that the neoliberals have not only a vision of the kind of economy that they want, they have a vision of what it means to be a human being in the 21st century. And that is part of their story. And what happens is that I think the left doesn't have that kind of sense of a larger vision anymore. It may have had it at one time, but it doesn't have it. There's no philosophical aspect to the idea that, you know, somehow all we need is more regulation and that's going to fix everything. See, so I think there's a real strong difference between a well-developed thought collective, which is what the neoliberals are, and I think a sort of a catch-as-catch-can coalition, which is what the left is right now.
There is not much of a left. I mean, what are you calling the left?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting issue. And that takes us back to your first question. That I think that somebody like, say, Joseph Stiglitz really conceives himself as being of the left in many ways, in practical terms, is of the left. But he tends to undermine himself by maintaining at the same time that neoclassical economics will, in its current state, will provide enough of guidance for the left to develop a program. And see, I think that that becomes one symptom of what I'm trying to point to, is that there isn't that kind of sort of self-reflective criticism that one finds in the neoliberals with their critique of the of classical liberalism. The left, I think, can't really carry on an extended conversation of, you know, how much their own heritage has to be rethought. So, yeah, I know I'm not helping you out by, you know, giving you a title of all the appropriate people who are on the left. It's just that I think that there is no equivalent intellectual thought collective on the left to offset the strength of the thought collective on the right.
But we also on the left don't have a lot of wealthy patrons to underwrite our work the way Mont Pelerin and Heritage and AEI have.
Right. Well, that's true. But this is where the historian in me comes out. Because one thing that's really noteworthy is that when Mont Pelerin was sort of trying to, you know, put together its support, especially in the early days in the 40s and 50s, the rich people who did give them money wanted to also control their discussions. And what they found quite early on is that they had to defend themselves against their own patrons, too, and sometimes, you know, shut down some of their patrons. See, so I mean, that is a sense of a purpose and a clearness of insight that makes them not simple reproductions of whatever it is that their patrons want. And let me give you just one example of that, that you would think that, oh, well, they would necessarily be pro-corporate because corporations were important part of their early funding. But interestingly enough, they wanted to revise the corporations, too. They felt corporations were sort of quasi-socialist entities that needed to be rethought and sort of, you know, made lean and mean and, you know, more of its functions outsourced and so forth. So they were willing to try to change some of their most important patrons as well.
Now, last question. Do you foresee a time when we will be shoveling dirt on the coffin of neoliberalism?
Not in the near future. But obviously the reason I write a book like this is because I think it's time to start to imagine what would a serious intellectual response to this movement look like. And, you know, just one hint so that I'm not completely a downer here. I think that one of the places that the rethinking has to begin is to rethink this whole idea that the market is some kind of epistemic phenomenon, that the market ultimately helps us or guides us to the truth, that the market is a knowledge machine. I think that is a place that the left really has to start thinking. And notice that that's not the usual places that one hears the kinds of discussions that one sees on the blogs on the left and so forth, that they need to rethink the whole idea, the whole epistemic side of market theory.
That was Philip Murawski, a professor at Notre Dame and author of Never Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste, from Verso. I certainly agree that the left no longer has a larger vision, but Murawski's claim that the dominance of neoliberalism has little to do with the interests of the rich strikes me as very wrong. I think Marx had it right in this famous passage. The ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. That is, the class which is the ruling material force of society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. The class which has the means of material productions at its disposal has control at the same time over the means of mental production, so that thereby, generally speaking, the ideas of those who lack the means of mental production are subject to it. The ruling ideas are nothing more than the ideal expression of the dominant material relationships grasped as ideas. Word. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a danceable hymn to the neoliberal self, from the soundtrack to Party Monsters, Money, Success, Fame, Glamour, performed by Felix de Housecat versus Pop-Tarts. Till next week, bye.